The great philosopher Kierkegaard said, "Life can only be understood backwards, but it must be lived forwards." Looking back only results in learning for people who have that time to think, and many of us are so busy with day-to-day demands that we rarely have time to reflect. And that's why we started What I Wish I Knew. It's for those moments when you realize that just a bit of insight might have come in handy if you had it in advance. I'm Mike Irwin.
And I'm Simon Dorr. So we talk with people from all walks of life, from startup entrepreneurs to Fortune 500 CEOs, professional athletes to weekend warriors, from artists and to designers to even engineers who became designers, from those who dream to those who dream then actually do. They all have three things in common. None are perfect, all are humble, and each have truly incredible learnings. In What I Wish I Knew, they share these lessons with you.
Join us at whatiwishinewshow.com. Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you find your favorite podcasts. And please share and subscribe to What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Dorr. Welcome to What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Dorr. We're thrilled today to be talking with Bob Reif. And many people have heard of Bob Reif, but even more have heard of the brands that he's worked with. So Bob is the founder of one of my favorite brands called Merrell Footwear, which I wore for many years and still do wear and own much of their stuff. But that was only part of it. He was also the guy who started Nike Golf and signed this young kid out of Stanford called Tiger Woods. Later on, he served as CEO of Reef Sandals and Sanuk as well, two footwear companies. He spent time with, you know, Reichle and Molitor and some of the other ski brands. So there's a really good chance that if there's an outdoor or sports or active lifestyle brand that you either like, you own, or you want, there's a darn good chance that Bob Reif was involved in it. So Bob, welcome to What I Wish I Knew.
Well, thank you. I wish I knew some answers to all those questions.
So we thought, you know, it's such an impressive resume that we could pretty much stop the show right there, because, you know, all I want to do is kind of sit here and say, wow. And I'm honored to know you as a business person, but even more so to be able to call you a friend. But so take us back where you're from and how is it that this outdoor business powerhouse, where did he come from and how did he end up there?
Well, there's a lot of things. Just a couple of corrections. Actually, Randy Merrell and John Schweitzer and one other guy who I'm having a brain cramp. Most important one. We're actually the founders of Merrell. And so for me, I was the first business guy to get there to try and help. So I was the number four person on that team. And we got it going together. Clark Mattis is the guy who is the real genius behind it. And Clark is a designer. He still works for him. So there's a long story there. But I have a very common background. My dad was in the service in the Navy. And so we moved all over the place and every 2 years. And luckily enough, San Diego is one of the many spots we lived several times. And when I was 13, I was involved in a fortunate accident, really hurt my lower leg. And at the same time, we moved to San Diego. And I went down to the San Diego Navy Hospital, pretty famous place, for some follow-up surgery. And the doctor told me, said, you know, it would be good for you to get into the water if you can, like if you can go swimming in the ocean. We lived in Coronado. It was a half a block away. So I took up surfing in 1958. And it was sort of the pivotal moment in my life in terms of catching on to the outdoor business. A little bit later, my dad got reassigned to Japan the exact same day that I was supposed to go off to college. So they went to Japan and I went to CU and rode the bus up to University of Colorado, first time I'd ever seen it. I had $100 from my dad in my pocket. And when I got there, I discovered it was a country club. I didn't know that. Nobody told me, and certainly nobody told my mom and dad. So I went to work like right away and I'd never recovered. So I worked, survival jobs as a hasher, cooking food, cleaning pots and pans for food. And I worked at the local ski shop in the afternoon, and I was a night ski operator at Lake Eldora at night. And the rest of the time I was a student. So I never got anywhere in college at all, but I did learn how to work. And it was during Vietnam. So if I didn't maintain a relationship with the university, even a vague one, I was going to be drafted. So I went to visit my mom and dad 1 year and came back in the middle of a semester in pretty desperate situations and fearful of being drafted. So I went back to my mom and dad's home base, which is up in the Dakotas in Deadwood. I went to work as a gold miner, 6,000 feet underground. And that's plenty of time to think down in the dark there and the rock temperature, like 110 degrees. And after about 3 months of that, I decided this is never going to happen to me again. And I started in on a foray to return back to the things that I loved. And so Ellen and I moved to San Francisco and I went into the local ski shop and got a job. And from there, I found out there's these things called reps, you know, sales reps. And I found out that you actually didn't have to work that hard. You just sold some stuff. It's a ski business, you know, in the old days, and you got like 9 or 10 months off, depending upon how clever you were. I wasn't that clever, but I could get 2 months off. So we started selling a brand called K2, first year of K2, and a company called Salomon. You probably heard of those. And our company was a little distributor company, so I would be selling hats, gloves, goggles, K2, and Salomon. From Seattle to Fresno, you know, I don't know, everybody won't know how, that's a long ways, like a 800 mile territory. But I learned right away, you know, how to handle different brands, how to solve conflicts, sales channel conflicts, and it was a really good background for me to get into business. And, you know, from that repping job, I became a product manager and then a sales manager and then product manager for Italian shoe company, which we finally opened a home office in the U.S. It's called Nordica. Did pretty well. It's still out there. And from Nordica, the owner of Nordica, after 2 or 3 years, discovered that our skill set didn't match his expectations. And so I had the opportunity to find a new job. Went down to Reichle Molitor and joined Heinz Herzog there. And we sold Reichle Head Tyrolia Fisher, among other things, in high volume. Small company, went from 12 million to 54 million pretty quickly. And unfortunately, the owner of the company met an had a fatal car accident. It's kind of the end of the company. And a friend of mine owned Merrill on behalf of, he had tried to help John and Clark and Randy Merrill with the brand, but they're kind of at a dead end. And so I went up there and joined those guys. And you know what happened with Merrill's pretty good. We had a lot of discoveries. It was the advent of Excel, which I was trying to figure out how it worked. It looked like a little tic-tac-toe thing. And as I was trying to map my way through how to learn Excel, I discovered that I could make some columns, like hiking boots could have subdivisions, like, you know, touring boots, the approach shoes, you know, all this. And you could put year 1, 2, and 3 and start to plot. Not as stupid as it sounds, that was the beginning of my really forward thinking about strategic planning and implementation, execution, tactics. So it was a pretty cool experience. And you know, Merrill outgrew its shoes. It was growing faster than anybody could finance, so it became necessary to sell it. And the owner lived down in the Bahamas, and he entrusted us to set it up and sell it. And we did that. I think it wasn't a very effective sale in retrospect. Obviously, we sold it at $40 million, and I can't remember how much cash went between the principal partners, but the original founders, John and Clark and Randy Merrill, didn't get anything out of it, unfortunately. And even me, I put in quite a bit of money, and it took 3 or 4 years to get the money back after the sale. I got exactly back what I put in, and I learned my first lesson. You asked me what about lessons. I learned partnerships are difficult. I learned that the so-called earned equity, sweat equity for year 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 10% means nothing because you have no rights in actuality. I learned to distrust lawyers. I learned that I did not have a finance background and have anything to do with selling anything to a smarter person is a bad idea. Because of course, you want to minimize the opportunity. So, you know, it's quite a learning experience for me. And a kind of a shell shock, honestly, Michael, you know, I just don't have the background. So it was sort of caving in on me from all sides. You know, you don't know enough finance. You know, you're scrappy, you know, you have some good attributes. You know, in the middle of the whole experience, I think I told you once I went to a Yankelevich and Scully presentation about demographics, which I'd never heard of. You know, I don't know. I thought it was a disease. I don't know what I thought it was. But I found out that I'm 1 year ahead of the baby boom generation. And it slowly occurred to me that things that I like to do, somebody else might like to do, like maybe 20 million other men. And honestly, that's what got me up to thinking about Merrill. Could it, you know, go from that narrow one model or two or three model collection into something like with 25 models? And could we sell to men and women? And could we have price points from $99 to $350 instead of $350 to $329? You know, so I learned about selling in the middle of the pyramid and of demand. And I learned about successful pricing strategies, which is still very simple. If you want sell through, you price your products near what consumers expect to pay for it, and you'll never have a problem. So all in all, this was a big learning experience. And one of my customers in this crazy experience was Jerry Lauren, who's Ralph's brother from Polo. And they were going to start this thing called Polo Sport. And they came up to see Clark Madison and I, and we both thought it was never going to work. But they wanted to borrow our authenticity in the outdoors so that when they launched Polo Sport, it was actually by Merrill, if you can believe it. Wow. And they wanted some big technical breakthroughs, like they wanted P-O-L-O printed on the front of the outsole, you know. And we go, no, that's impossible. That could never be done. But we found out that it could be done. And in the ensuing experience, you know, you're dealing with Ralph and Jerry Lawn and Polo, and we're a tiny little company. We were so flattered to have any influence, but Jerry Lauren is a genius. He's the big brother. Ralph is the little brother, but Jerry taught us to think about products without regard to money. Like what is the perfect product? If you look into your treasure chest, what do you see? And that really helped us amplify our thinking about the possibilities for Merrill. So when we sold Merrill, I was without a job. And I thought, well, maybe I'll go back and ask Ralph and Jerry, it's actually Jerry, if I could make golf shoes for them. Because I thought, you know, I'm getting interested in golf. I played golf when I was a kid. And, you know, I was thinking about the people behind me. Maybe there's some other guys that might be interested in golf. And, I ended up at Nike Golf. It was an amazing experience. So I'm doing a lot of talking, Mike, so you help me out here.
Yeah, no, let's pause there and kind of go back on Merrill, because it seemed like that was a formative experience. I mean, just to kind of recap, mm-hmm. you went from, you know, kind of becoming, you know, working in a ski shop to becoming a rep, and then through that eventually you end up, you know, meeting people that lead you to help these guys out and creating, you know, in creating Merrill. If you think about, you know, kind of at the back end, as you look back at on this amazing creation of Merrill, you know, you covered off on pricing, and you talked about, you know, product, and you talked about, you know, kind of finding your market and kind of selling to mm-hmm. the middle of the field where people, you know, more of the customers are. It's easier to look back on things and see what kind of came out of it. But if you're talking to someone, as you do all the time these days, at the front end of their entrepreneurial experience, what would be the two or three things that emerge from your experience with Merrill that you feel like is instructive?
Well, a couple of things. One is that the founders need to be honored. I mean, Randy came over from Utah to Vermont. That was a shell shock. He only stayed there 5 or 6 months. Actually, I've never met Randy Merrill. And so he departed. And John Schweitzer, really fantastic guy, and Clark Mattis, a guy that I'd worked with in the ski industry, had laid it all out on the line. And it was, you know, it's for every young brand, there's a precarious moment where you are going to take the next step into the unknown. And Clark and John were fully committed. They didn't have any more resources. So they brought in an outside investor, I would say, who proved to be kind of judgmental, and he didn't like what he was seeing. So that's when he contacted me, and I stepped into this little hornet's nest, and I probably didn't make it better. But in retrospect, you take the creative genius and you let them do what they do, and put in above them finance people. Mm-hmm. So that the soul of the brand remains. And I tell this to VC people now, you know, you want to buy this brand because these guys created this amazing thing. And then the first thing you do is you handcuff them and throw them out, or tell them that, you know, a bunch of stipulations that basically quash creativity. So, you know, I know that this whole experience for the founders of Merrill was traumatic. I mean, Randy went back to Utah. Clark stayed on through the sale of the brand. And the, you know, the new buyers after we sold to Brown Brothers, Harriman, and GE Capital, a couple of sharp pencils, I can tell you that. And they buffed up the balance sheet, which I would say, in all honesty, I didn't ever know about. Never thought about a balance sheet. We're just trying to, you know, constantly increase sales and somehow pay for the inventory and so on, all those challenges. But when they passed it on, you know, the new buyer wanted everybody to move to Grand Rapids, Michigan. Well, no offense, but that's not on my Mecca list. So, you know, it dispersed everybody. So what I learned is that we didn't have the financial acumen to succeed to begin with, and that we were on this growth path that was very destructive for the founders because we couldn't keep up with it. And we were naive. So our solution to this was to create more products and sell more. And the more we sold, the less we could afford. And, you know, and it led to premature sale of the company. But remember, Michael, this is a long time ago. This is before the VC community was what it is today, you know. So, but still, what I learned is if you're a brand founder, stick to the guns, find benign money. Don't, you know, the best partner is one you can pay off. Like, it's better to borrow the money than to give up your equity, in my still current opinion. Because you, if you take a loan, you can pay it back and they're gone. If you take an inappropriate partner, you're going to have them for life. And sooner or later, if they're the money person, they're going to wonder how come they haven't tripled their money yet. And you're going to be talking branding and they're going to be talking getting my money back. That's the war of the worlds, right?
I also get the sense, Bob, you described it, you know, your early piece on at college and enjoying the time in the sports world. And really, I'm getting the sense of that interface, strong interface of people along the way. And then you describe almost that, well, from what I'm learning, you know, what I wish I knew here, this self-awareness, you know, you knew you had the EQ, you knew you could get on with people, etc. But your successes, I'm sensing, have come through an understanding and acceptance that you know you don't necessarily have the competence to do it all. Is that something you would give people as a piece of advice here?
Well, you know, one of the amazing things about today's marketplace, I feel, Simon, is that it's surprisingly collaborative. That's a new thing. I don't know whether it's people reaching my age, 75 now, almost 76, and going, I have no secrets. I mean, if I can help you succeed, I want to. But in those days, it was different. And also, I would say through, I don't know, I'm eccentric.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that's the right word. But at any rate, never been the normal or in that normal world. I've always been on the periphery of things. And I've discovered that there's a lot of us out there that couldn't get through college. Mine was just circumstantial. My dad lived in Japan and I lived in Colorado. And, you know, if I needed money, I needed to ask him like 3 months in advance so that mail would come. So that there's a problem. But yeah. So I think one of the things, luck is a big part of everybody's life, but I was lucky that my eccentricity, I wasn't penalized for being eccentric. And I started to fall in with these people. I mean, think about it. To be, you know, in my CU life, to know Bob Viatti, who was the U.S. team coach, and to know his brother, who ran a nice ski shop in Boulder, and to get access to the ski industry from the top of the pyramid, not from the bottom. I didn't realize at the time, but that was the beginning of networking, which is the most critical thing you can possibly do, especially if you like people, which I do, you know, and I like people that are eccentric and different. So anyhow, as you go along, I mean, I'll give you some examples of the eccentric people. I mean, well, first of all, Bob Biatti, you know, a wonderful person in the ski industry, really an agent of change. And then Ralph and Jerry Lauren. It's so humbling to even be able to say that you know Jerry Lauren and to hear the stories, the branding stories of Polo and Lauren in the beginning. Fantastic man, really very helpful. And then luck out to work for some guy like Phil Knight. You know, another really eccentric genius and somebody who, by the way, was accessible, you know, no problem. you know, almost on a drop by basis if you had some problem. I mean, so it was really cool, you know. And then as we changed our focus, and I came down to work for Ely Calloway, another genius person, you know, a real innovator, a complete agent of change, fantastic person. So, you know, I've just been lucky. And, you know, as I got up back into the surf world, just completing the loop of my life, I started out in surf. And so when I realized there's a brand called Reef, it was the same as my name. They misspelled theirs. But, you know, I just went down and knocked on the door to see if they happened to have a CEO search or president search going on. And to be honest, I was lucky their previous candidate, unfortunately, had passed away very unexpectedly. And I think they were on the heels. I walked in, you know, they said, well, what have you done? I said, well, I don't know. I sold millions of shoes and many millions of dollars worth of apparel, and it seems like you do both. I thought maybe we have something in common, and we kind of hit it off. And that worked out. And when we sold Reef, I was once again surfing and walking up the steps, and I ran into Jeff Kelly, who owns Sanook, and he said, hey, what are you doing? I'm doing nothing. I said, well, you want to help me? And that led a whole nother, you know. So it's always been this network among people. And you know, if you want to learn something about yourself, hang out in the creative community, and you will find out if you're a maker. All those guys I mentioned to you are makers, or if you are more a commercial guy.
And let's say you're commercial, Bob, and mm-hmm. like you just alluded to, you have that high level of entrepreneurship and creativity. And let's say the people listening to this, or some people, are not that. Are you recommending go and make sure you mix with those creatives along the way?
Well, I think the first thing, Simon, is to figure out who you are. Like, I'm a commercial guy in a group of very creative people, I think, or people that have had the courage to be themselves through thick and thin. I think that's probably a better description of them. But I'm not that guy. I do not have the aperture for opportunity that a film night has. For instance, when I took him out to follow Tiger Woods the first time at the U.S. Amateur up in Portland, as we were walking back, he said, you know, this kid has a possibility to be the first $1 billion individual athlete in the history of sports. And I thought to myself, how the hell does he know this? He just met him. He didn't even actually meet him. He just watched him. And so I'm walking back thinking, I wonder if we should sign him. And Phil's already like shifted gears and is thinking way forward. And so, you know, if you have to, I believe you have to find your place in this community. So oddly enough, a lot of people who are super creative have zero interest in execution. Makers are fiddlers. Makers will take an X and they'll keep screwing around with it until it turns into an Apple computer. And then their mind wanders off, and along comes Guy Kawasaki and said, I think I can help sell those things you dreamed up. You know, and so I'm not Guy Kawasaki, but I'm a guy who luckily imported goods, priced goods, went through the design, development, commercialization stage, you know, with Merrill, learning how to do all this stuff. Then I got exposed to Nike, who has this amazing capacity to make things happen. You probably noticed it. You know, and they have a very simple formula there, which is, you know, make world-class product, assign it to a world-class athlete, market the hell out of it with fire, surprise, and audacity. All it takes is money. but still in the back of my mind, it was a great lesson, and I've always tried to think about that as we go along. But I think by assigning myself to the role of trying to help the founder's dream come true, enabled me to work with a lot of people without conflicting with them about who's the creator. And I have deep, deep, deep respect for people who make things.
Let's pause there for a second. So I want to talk about Nike later, you know, in just a minute. But yeah. I wanted to ask you, Bob, you know, you made this distinction between maker or kind of commercial person. And how do you make the distinction though? But if you're sort of the executor, if you will, because an idea doesn't have any value until it's turned into a business. And so, you know, by your definition, makers are fiddlers. And if they don't turn it into a business, then all they really are is fiddling and it doesn't come to anything. As you look at things, how do you make that distinction?
Not all creators are just fiddlers. I mean, But creators are product-oriented people in my world, not services-oriented, but product-oriented. and they will focus on the product endlessly. And as you know, Michael, we've laughed about this within our group. We've discovered some traits for the creators that are basically called founderitis. And they can't, that's the founder who can't let go to enable a product to go to scale, because it's never right enough. It's not quite done, but it will be soon. You know, it's, and so, you know, that's what I mean by like that singular focus. But there are many creators who also know how to make it happen. I'm thinking about Bob Hurley at Hurley and, you know, things like that. But still in my case, I think I have some intuitive skills about creativity, and it's, you know, like that old saw about you, you know, you don't know what you like with in art, but you, when you see it, you know, right. So in my case, I mean, I'll give you an example of Jeff, you know, Kelly, we're making Sanuk sandals. They're really awesome sandals. We're really killing it. We're doing very well making sandals. And Jeff said, we should make shoes. And, oh, shit, I've been in this conversation before. It's the, you know, it's the creep, right? Now we're going to do mission creep and we're going to make shoes. And all these barriers went up in my brain. And he sensed that. And so he sort of excluded me from the development of the Sidewalk Surfer, right? And when it was more done or done-ish, he actually let other people try it before me. I was kind of having hurt feelings about it. Finally, he gave me a pair and the light went on. That these shoes are actually more comfortable than sandals. Sandals heretofore had set the precedent, right? I mean, that's the standard, you know, nothing could be more comfortable than a nice soft pair of flip-flops. Well, that was not true. And so when we got the shoe thing going, it was going gangbusters. So that's my flaw, is previous experience. It throws up barriers that can inhibit creativity. And, you know, I always said that, you know, I don't think brand extensions work. I mean, Budweiser does not have any wine, to the best of my knowledge. So they must have just stuck to beer, and I thought we should stick to sandals. But that's a drawback, and that's why creators are often afraid of people like me, that you'll stifle the creative thing and you'll stop us from achieving to work. So it's, you know, this is the interplay. And when you're in our business, I would say surf-centric attitude here in the coast, you know, there's some strong feelings. So...
But Bob, on that note, though, how do you make the distinction between something that is just an idea versus something that's worth doing? Because on the one hand, your judgment is going to be informed by your experience.
Yeah.
But
my first thought is, I always have the same attitude on this. Is it clever? Is it unique? Is it unique to vision? And can it be brought to scale? So, you know, when I was younger, I didn't think about those things. But now, you know, I think about, you know, having product in the middle of the pyramid. I found out that 20% of 100% of the market is much better than 1% of 1 or 100% of 1%. You know, and so I look at products, you know, from a demographic point of view. Who is the end audience? Is it big enough? Is there space? Is the noise level too high? Is there a chance? Is it an interrupter or disruptor of a current technology, and so on? So those are just filters that are in there. Yeah.
So I also get from what you describe, Bob, and you talk about starting up your spreadsheets and looking at demographics, as you call it, which is so important, and people know that these days. That must be a key insight here. You know, like you say, in a proliferation of a world that's potentially a generic, you know, how do you make yourself distinct? Mm-hmm. Is that something you've kind of evoked as you built businesses, and something you would instill in other people?
Definitely. I mean, I think you're especially today, Simon, more than any time in my life, it's very important that you stick to your branding. And if you're not a branded product, you know, a branded, for me, a definition of a brand is a product or service that evokes an emotional response from the consumer. It can be love. The opposite of love, interestingly, is not hate, it's indifference. That is fatal, right? So you got to be provocative, and you have to protect the people that are like that. If you're somebody like me, and give them as much room as possible and all the respect you possibly can. And I don't know, Simon, if Michael has told you, but here at San Diego Sport Innovators, we're going back down the list and talking to the creators, and we call it our Legend series. It's a personal interview, not filmed, for 20 people only. First come, first serve, and come and see the true story of Quicksilver, the start of Quicksilver, or Bob Hurley, or Jeff, or Prana, all these people, and searching for this, the very same question, you know. Because from a creator's point of view, how do you find a partner that'll help make it happen? You know, without expansion of the ego.
I'm interested, Bob, in just a thought there then. So in some other categories, drinks, for example, there's this kind of urban drive in some respects, you know, new entrance into a market. You know, again, just the parallels here and just the learning for people. How do you, you know, how do you get that going? Once you believe you've got something that's the unmet need, is it walking to store? Is it getting into places?
Well, I think the first thing to do is make sure that you have something that other people want. In order to do that, you have to find out who the other people are. So you have to be honest with yourself. If you come up with a new cold brew coffee and you're going to go up against Starbucks, you know, you better have your act together. On the other hand, what's really interesting now to me, Simon, is that in my day, if we had a product, we would see, oh, shoot, this is going to be perfect for REI. So we get our act together. We race up to REI. We have a nice relationship with them. It's a, you know, it's a great company. And they would embrace some change, and we'd work something out, and then we would think about where else we could sell it. In today's world, good retailers are finding brands. Brands are not finding good retailers. And it's a big damn difference. If a retailer finds you, you are the dog and he is the tail. If you find a retailer, you are the tail and he is the dog. And so I think it has made young or contemporary, truly innovative brand founders much more aware of the relationship with the consumer and skipping all filters.
Mm. So does that mean direct to consumer?
It means initially these days direct to consumer. Okay. But as I say, it does not exclude retail. But it's better if the retailers contact you and say, gee, I love your new widget. Think I can sell some. Because then you can say, well, I could use some help selling some, but I don't need help going to Amazon. I don't need help selling it in Europe or Asia. I just need help selling it up there in Point Doom or Malibu. If that's what you're thinking, addressing your community, hey, we're on board. And, you know, you have to resist talking to the really big distribution. Much as you want them, you don't want that kind of distribution for a young brand, because they confuse the consumer. It's very hard for all retail to tell your story correctly. And if you don't have a story, by the way, with your brand, you might as well not start. You know, so it's you need somebody to tell the story. You're going to tell your story best yourself. So I like what Jack Ma said. The Jack Ma is the founder of Alibaba. We went to a conference 3 or 4 years ago, and he said, look, the brand, the company of the future, I call it the 30 under 30, if I remember it right. I'm going to paraphrase him. I hope he doesn't call me. If he does, it'd be awesome to talk to Jack Ma. But he just said it's going to be a company with 30 employees or less, led by a CEO under 30. And the distribution is going to be Alibaba. And he said, within 2 years, so that's now, today, and I believe this is true, he said, we will be able to deliver any product that Alibaba sells to any consumer in the world within 72 hours. Wow. This is a while back, right? And look at Alibaba. I mean, it has some warts, but what an amazing achievement. And so, you know, when I take his lesson, when I took it home, I started thinking about this, you know, then. It makes total sense to go direct to the consumer. It doesn't mean you go there exclusively. It means you go there first. You go there with your first products. You work with them to develop your product. I mean, if you look into some of the books like The Art of the Start, Guy Kawasaki, he always says, make your first product good enough. Your consumer will help make it perfect. I believe that too. So these days, I think, Simon, if you look at the time frame, it's now compressed for the development product because the communication is so expanded. You search out for your consumer, you see if it's relevant, and then you have to be very careful with what your branding is all about for today's customer. If you're insensitive to social justice, if you're insensitive to all the, you know, fundamental kind of ecological issues, you're just not going to succeed, or you're not going to succeed with our audience. You're going to be selling, instead of a brand, you'll have a label. Labels do great, by the way, in America, but that's not in our space, Simon. It's just not who we are. When I say we, the outdoor business, the surf-centric or oceanic community, motorcycle community, bike community, pretty tight what they think and believe.
So as you take that forward, then, how do you make the distinction between, you know, how in sort of the discovery phase of starting a business or starting a brand, how do you decide what's worth doing? And you see this all the time with SDSI, but how should an entrepreneur decide what's worth doing versus what was something that they really like?
Well, that's a tough question. I hope this is okay to say, but the it is always in the shit somewhere, right? And so, you know, when an entrepreneur thinks about it, you have to be honest with yourself. I mean, does this make me happy and do something in my life that makes me happy? And I can think of plenty of people like that, that has no commercial application. They're actually just as happy doing that as they are making something with a commercial application. It's just the focus. And, you know, to me, I've learned some things about this focus. My focus is too narrow, but I won't name the person, but I have a friend who just made it a better bungee cord. Now, it was important to him because the old bungee cord wasn't working. But think about how many bungee cords are sold in the world every single day. This could be a huge idea. Like the guy who made the little plastic tab when you close up bread and you snick it. So, you know, you look at this stuff and now I look at it from a little different perspective that, you know, there could be some major scale things. I think you remember we had this AccuLeaf and SDSI. Do you remember that little device? It's a little plastic thing with some tensile strength. One of our members discovered that if you pinch this part of your hand here, the crotch here, this is a headache relief mechanism in Eastern medicine. So he just made a device that goes on there. I don't know, they might cost a quarter to make. They retail for $10. That's yay. So that's high volume, high margin, low cost. You know, that's things I think about now as I'm older, but I don't know, individually, you just have to follow your heart. There's a lot of heartache in creating products and a lot of failures before they're successes. And you just have to weather the storm and believe in yourself.
So let's talk about Nike then. You know, you go to Nike, and at the time Nike wasn't really, I mean, they were thinking about golf. I mean, they'd been primarily into shoes and, you know, golf was probably one of their early sort of sport specific, you know, businesses. Right. But, you know, you look at what happened and how you did it with Tiger Woods. What's sort of the lesson in that? Cause they were already a massive brand. They were already excellent at developing great product. What was different about their approach to golf?
There's totally a formula there, believe me. And there's some really significant Nike employees, not just executives, mid-level, you know, like category sales managers, who are brilliant people. And Nike is the cathedral of creativity in my mind. And there's plenty of other churches, but that's the cathedral. You know, that's where it happens. But, you know, my intersection with Nike was really very improbable. And working on these golf shoes with Polo. I mean, Polo didn't seem, I was working with what I thought was going to be a Polo shoe, and also was talking with a New Balance. And so I'm interested in golf. And oddly enough, one of the guys who helped, who started a ski magazine during my ski years, took over Golf Digest as the big role. Anyhow, and Tom and I were playing golf, and when he couldn't fill out a foursome, they do a lot of social golf. He'd call me, and so I'm playing at places I normally might be able to caddy at, and, you know, I'm trying to pretend like I belong there, trying to tuck my shirt in all the way around and all that stuff that's important in golf. So I bought some Nike golf shoes to test for my ideas, and they were killing me, and I'm playing golf with Tom, and, you know, I was laughing and said, oh, they should call these things like the bucket of blood. They're killing my feet, you know, and you got to walk on those fancy courses. There's no riding in golf carts. So Tom said, you should call Nike and tell them. And I go, yeah, right. Would I do call 1-800-NIKE? And he said, yeah, that's actually what you do. And, you know, I'll give you some names. So this was going on in my mind. At the same time, a friend of mine that was in Canada also during our ski years was co-representing in Canada the same brands we had, in particular Dynastar. And so he's a clever guy. We would do all the marketing and he would say, we're in Canada, that's what we say too, right? So we had a really funny relationship where I felt like I was doing the work and he was benefiting from it. We developed a really good friendship. He went on to get into the hockey business, and I made this business plan, you know, for golf shoes, and I sent it to him, and he didn't respond. And that's not normal for him. He's a good friend. And I'm chewing my fingernails and waiting for his feedback. A couple of weeks later, he said, Bob, I can't tell you this, but I'm calling you from the Northwest, and we've just sold our hockey company to a big company you've heard of in Portland. You know, that's awesome. You know, thanks a lot. You know, I've been sitting here for 2 weeks waiting for you to call me back, and you haven't done anything, and but you called me up to tell me you're a millionaire now. So that's, I'm so pissed off at you. You know, and he laughed and he said, well, here's the good news. He said, are you still doing that golf thing? I said, well, I'm sitting here, you got my plan right in front of you. And he said, well, as we were wrapping up the deal, the founder of the big company up in Portland said, next up is golf. So you should get in touch with him. So we have this pincher movement going on, you know, and I'm sure that who I was completely misrepresented by my friend Pierre. And on the other hand, I called up the president, Tom Clark, and said, hey, Tom, you know, bucket of blood. We had a laugh about it. He's a really great guy, very product oriented. He said, well, I'll be in New York. Let's meet next week. And we went there. And I told you before this, very ironic, but I asked Tom, I said, do you know anything about golf? And, you know, he's a track and field guy. And he goes, no, he's wearing all black and just kind of compact. He goes, no, I don't know about golf. And the message I got was, and I don't care, but I'm here. We're making bad shoes. We should fix them. You know, this is what I'm thinking is going on in his head. And he said, well, do you know anything about golf? And I said, well, I know something about it. I played most of my life. He said, but have you ever been in the business? I go, no, I've never been in the golf business. And he said, well, he said, there's like 1,000 guys in the golf business that want this job. And I said, well, first of all, I didn't know you had a job. So I'm encouraged because I don't have one. But I said, I don't know. If you don't know anything about golf, let me tell you, it has an unfortunate history, a legacy that they're working on, but they haven't overcome. And basically, it's been racist, sexist, and elitist. And if you want to import those values into Nike, you should hire one of those 1,000 guys because they know all about it. I said, my idea is, why don't you think about trying to make golf look like Nike? That would be more fun. And he goes, that is a good answer. And so I don't know, Tom, I never asked them, but anyhow, a couple of weeks later, I got the invite to go up to Portland, and it began like a cataclysmic 3 years of intense learning. For a small brand guy to get up into that juggernaut was really an amazing experience. But that's how I got there. I mean, I certainly did not earn my way in. I don't know what happened, but anyhow, luck interceded, and I ended up at Nike. Stayed there for 3 years, and was a general manager. And that job, just as I was departing, became president. So I was able to quickly scratch out general manager for the president on my resume. And yeah, it was quite an experience.
Still, that's a genius move, though, Bob. You talk about maybe not earning your way in. Maybe I think you earned your way in by having, you know, the clarity of you know, an answer like you gave. And
well, you know, I think from my heart, you know, and you know, playing around Metro New York in fancy clubs with Tom, you know, you didn't see any people of color. Right. You didn't see women. You know, they were split by religion, right? I mean, there was nothing good going on there. And I don't know, just, you know, it's probably the little guy chip on the shoulder thing made me say that, you know, so.
Well, that's the most valuable, we talked about it earlier, Bob, that's the most valuable insight, yeah, is your, you know, we call it in marketing words, as you know, the experiential. Yeah, you've experienced it and you're bringing it back to a guy who who hasn't experienced that. So that is the DNA of that.
I think the credit lies all on Nike, because Simon, as the story evolves, you know, you've got an outsider, scrappy guy. I've been paying for myself for quite a long time. You know, joining a company where they do manufacturing, and those guys do commercialization, and those guys do prototyping, those guys do design, and that you have to activate the silos. Well, I've been my own silo all my life. It's been a shortcoming. So it was very hard for me to learn how to, you know, how to make the process work. But in the ensuing 3 years, I found out that the most fundamental truth about Nike is not its muscle, its ability to, you know, to create product and sell it and have a great brand. Nike is really an athlete's rights company. And when you think about what makes Nike go round, if you just think about it from the athlete's point of view, it's much easier to understand why they support Kaepernick, right? Because Kaepernick is saying what he's got on his mind, and he's willing to put everything he has behind it. Nike supports that kind of an athlete every single time. On the other hand, if you're a cheater, you'll be you would leave Nike's wrapping arms in a microsecond. So it's and there's tons of stories in my day supporting Casey Martin, who was a handicapped golfer that wanted to ride in a cart because he couldn't walk 18 holes. We thought that was a worthy cause, right? And we got behind that. And, you know, Tiger, of course, a person of color coming into a sport that didn't celebrate that type of thing was yet another opportunity to advocate on behalf of the athlete. And of course, all the jaundiced people around the world go, oh, you're exploiting this guy or that guy. And but that's not my point of view.
What was the value that you brought then, Bob, to that golf fraternity where you talk about the silos and you'd equally had good knowledge of each of those silo areas? What value did you bring?
That's a great question. I mean, if I answered it myself, I'd say one, my edgy personality fits in a little bit more with the Nike world than does with the golf world. So I think maybe Tom Clark thought, well, this guy at least looks like one of us. You know? But, you know, inside Nike, it was a challenge. So the business plan was A, make golf part of Nike. That was hard. Because you've got a bunch of old fat white guys riding around in golf carts, just like Donald Trump, smoking cigars and not doing anything, representing the laziest, worst values in the world, right? I mean, that's the image of golf. And by the way, we don't want you at our club because of the way you look or your shape or your wrong religion or wrong color and all that bullshit. So, you know, I had that in my heart. That's true. And I had no idea that it coincided with what Tom Clark or Phil ultimately believed. I just didn't know that. So when I got up there, I was actually, I mean, the truth be known, I got an awesome team that supported me and endured my ignorance about how Nike works and so on. And so we had a common goal. But I was the least important person there. I got there with an idea that we should make golf part of Nike somehow. And I got a Nike guy named Rod Tallman, who's a longtime marketing specialist at Nike. He did that. Fantastic. And Nike had a fantastic indigenous person in their legal department who did the signings. So he's the guy that won over Tiger. It wasn't me. It wasn't Rod. It wasn't somebody else. It was a guy with a similar background. He's American Indian, a lawyer. And they talked about what does this mean to be a part of Nike, you know? So all that stuff was going on above my level of experience, not above my level of interest, but, you know, how do you deal with this? I mean, how do you sign checks that big? I mean, Tiger's first check was represented 80% of our revenue in the golf division. So when Phil asked me how to go, I went over and said, well, the Tiger's been successfully signed by Rudy. That's the good news. He goes, well, what's the bad news? I said, well, it more or less represents the size of our revenue. And so I'm not so sure that we did a really great thing. You know, I mean, and Phil said, well, you know, you are aware, which I was not, that Tiger will be part of the brand marketing here at Nike. And we have whatever $700 million annual marketing budget. So you shouldn't be staying awake at night worrying that you wasted money. So that was a revelation for me. But ultimately, we had a hard time interfacing with those silos, Simon.
Yeah.
Sorry, all these stories are so long because they're each one of these experiences is almost a lifetime experience, you know? So I'm sorry for being so verbose. But one day I was walking in the building, Phil walked out and he says, how's it going, that Nike, that golf thing? And I go, it's not going that great. And he said, well, what's the problem? So, you know, we're just having trouble getting, you know, getting design squared away when the marketing's confusing. So you guys should do it yourself. I thought that's what he meant. You know, I haven't worked in a, you know, in a 5,000 person corporation before that's all rigidly, you know, staircased with responsibility. So I talked to the guys over Wyden and Kennedy. The creative director there is obviously genius. I mean, the just do it guy. And he said, yeah, we can do some stuff. What did Phil say? He says, oh shit, I think that's a green light. So I began this political catastrophe of doing it myself. And it, not myself, it was the whole group, but you know, we really collaborated with Wyden and Kennedy. You might remember some of those Tiger Woods ads. The first thing to prove that we deserve to be a part of golf, Wyden and Kennedy did this thing that says, hey, we're playing golf, aren't we? And it was interviews like waiting in the parking lot at Bethpage at 4 o'clock in the morning to get a tee time. You know, it was a real insider's look of hardcore golfers that don't belong to a country club. And we proved that we were not the 800-pound gorilla in that situation. So that was good. Then the next thing that we wanted to do was we wanted to celebrate our athletes. And so we decided to get a global foursome. This is Rod Tallman's idea. We get somebody from each continent. So we did pretty well. We got Nick Price. People heard him before. And we got Michael Campbell, from who's a Maori native. How awesome is that? We got Alex Cheka, who is a Czechoslovakian who swam across the river into West Germany when he was 12 with his dad on a camping trip. They had a little swimming expedition over the other side. He started playing pro golf at 16. And so we still had one opening left. And then, you know, that's just a year later, along comes Tiger. And of course, this represented an amazing opportunity for us. And we all went out to the U.S. Amateur Pumpkin Ridge and watched him play. He won on the 36th hole on Sunday. So it was, you know, very tense. And I think inside Nike, that actually changed the attitude about golf. I mean, we did not see any fat white guys riding around in carts. We saw young athletes. And I think the light started going on that the golf is not an event, it's a sport. And if it's a sport, it's a place we belong. And if that's the case, then we already have three guys. We just need the fourth one in the U.S. Who could it be? And of course, we watched Tiger play. And I remember the next week, Phil called me up to his office and he said, Tiger's at Stanford. Yeah. I said, yeah, he's at Stanford. And he said, well, I'll tell you something, Bob. He said, I hope he stays there and gets his PhD. Because if he's going to play pro golf, we want him on our team. And that was sort of the beginning of, well, what's Tiger gonna do? And it's a tricky game, but we finally found out. And then the guys at Wyden and Kennedy did those fabulous ads, the best of which was the I Am Tiger Woods ads with all the kids of all nationalities and genders and colors, each one saying I'm Tiger Woods. It still gives me goosebumps thinking about it. So, you know, that launched a very successful business, footwear and apparel business, which is going on today. It's very strong. And
it seems like there's a common thread with a lot of this stuff, and that you know, whether it was, you know, at Nike or whatever, I mean, so much of what you do surrounds this degree of authenticity and purpose and the link mm-hmm. of having brand that means something that resonates to a particular audience. Is there something you can say about kind of the importance of brand as opposed to strictly product?
Well, I mean, if it's not, I think I have a good nose, you do too, for inauthentic. Inauthentic brands are called labels, right? and you can find them at Target or wherever. But I've been lucky, you know, when I got in the ski business, it was kind of left-handedly through the U.S. ski team. I mean, Spider Savage was a really close friend, you know, at CU. And, you know, these are Olympic stars and Jim Barrows and, you know, these types of people. So I've always been interested in the peak of the pyramid athlete. And so to me, it's authentic by definition. And, you know, there's plenty of those people around. Yvonne Chouinard is a fantastic example. I've only met him once, but it's just, you know, I just think for me personally to be involved with it, I want to make sure it's authentic. It's a real, makes a difference to the ultimate user. And if that's the case, like we did at Merrell, we started with a very expensive kind of a handmade boot by Randy Merrell, but it evolved into products for everybody, but always with a functionality. Never a price filler or that kind of monkey business. Never been involved with that.
Yeah. So let's shift gears here a little bit. I mean, you now devote so much of your time to sport innovators in San Diego, and you've on the back of this amazing entrepreneurial journey and brand creation and creating, you know, and having such an impact. Now you choose to spend so much of your time helping, you know, emerging entrepreneurs. Why do you do that?
Well, it's very funny you would ask me that of all people I know. Somebody, as I accused you earlier of having this disease, even worse than me. But, you know, well, there's a couple things. You know, San Diego Sport Innovators is a business development organization. We have about 110 companies, and they are those companies we just discussed. You know, they're authentic, game changers, small to large. I mean, we go from a tiny little surf company to Sony, as an example. I mean, it's a full spectrum of people that are focused in on our lifestyle here as an industry. And there's in San Diego County, there's 42,000 employees in this space and about $3 billion in economic impact. So oddly enough, all the kids that grew up from surfing and started skateboard companies became wealthy and succeeded, right? And so we have this wonderful little a group of business. And so we meet once a month. Now we're meeting virtually, and we do collaborative. We do collaborative breakfasts in Zoom. Got to bring your own breakfast and try not to get food on your face, because everybody will know. But, you know, we've just shifted gears and gone that way. But we also run this business accelerator, and in the accelerator, it's a 20-week program. It's open to anybody, any place in the world that they speak English and can coincide with our business hours. It's a 20-week program that basically takes a young company. It has to be post-revenue. You know, you have to have some money. You have to have a business plan. You have to have proof of concept. We take them, put them into a formal program. We put marketing ideas in the funnel. We make sausage. It comes out financial business plan. And maybe a three-year look ahead on how I'm going to do that, what it's going to take to do it. And it really arms young business people with all of the elements it takes to succeed. And you can see the interest waxes and wanes, because something's very interesting, like capitalization issues or things like that. You know, things you slept through in accounting and business 100, you get a lot of people interested in it. So we produce a nice product. We graduated 102 companies from this now, and you're among the mentors. There's 80 mentors. They have raised $90 million startup dollars, which is pretty good when all these companies are little. 51% are sport technology, and amazingly, 50% of the graduates are female. So this is the new world, my friend, and we're very proud of that. So it's awesome, as you know. The reason I do it is I've had this experience, and I didn't want to slip into relevancy. I didn't want to slip irrelevancy, pardon me. I didn't want to slip into telling my grandchildren these stories about way back in the day and all that kind of stuff. So I thought the next best thing would be to take this spectrum of experience and also skills, such as they are, and try to lend them to people to see if I can help them succeed. That's all. And the wonder of this is we have a class, two classes a year, right, between 5 and 10 entrepreneurs each. So in that time frame, we might see 40 business proposals. Michael, think about this. It's so exciting to see 40 people come to you with their dream. Isn't that awesome? Every time it happens, we sit in there and we fall in love with ideas that we see from young people coming along. And it just seems like a natural thing to help. And you and your mentor community at SDSI, there are 80 mentors now that are helping these companies. The average company gets over 100 hours of mentoring from us. And so the success rate, as you know, is around 85% over 12 years. So it's pretty damn successful. And it's very gratifying. It's the best job I ever, ever, ever had. Love it. Fantastic.
Well, there's no doubt that the world is a better place for what you and SDSI do. And, you know, I'm grateful to play a small part as a volunteer, but it's a terrific program. And I think for those listening, the amazingly cool thing about this is that these programs are now, you know, kind of without geographic borders. And so take a look at SDSI's website, and we will put a link in that when, you know, with this interview, so you can see it. But it's a remarkable program open to pretty much anybody anywhere. You get access to people that have the connections and the skill set to complement emerging entrepreneurs. So that,
you know, that's excuse me, Mike, thank you for that. But you know, what's interesting is that there are a lot of entrepreneurs in the space. And as I was saying, you know, that we in San Diego, we're an aspirational location, no doubt about it. It's awesome to live here. We appreciate it every day. But we have an ocean, we have desert, and we have proximity to Mexico. And we have Camp Pendleton up at the north, keeps LA and Orange County up there. All those Marines got their guns pointed north. But the reality is that the consumer that we're dealing with is a healthy living lifestyle consumer. And this market is in Austria, it's in Germany, it's in Italy, France, Australia, and New Zealand, as well as Portland, Boston. You know, so what we discovered is that where we thought we were a unique eco-business zone, actually we're dealing with a community of lifestyle and health and sustainability that actually goes around the world. So, you know, in the upper level at SDSI, if you were to join as a board member, you could participate in these executive learnings you're a board member, you know what it's like. There's a lot of amazing experiences and learnings that are being passed on, as well as opportunities, and sometimes transactions begin at this level and so on. So that's accessible to, you know, anybody who's in this space. And then same thing as you're just saying for the business development community, if you have a young brand, and for instance, you're in a small population country, you want to find out what the gateway to a larger market is to scale like the U.S., we have that capability to help those people. So it's fun. Awesome. You know what the really great thing is? I have no shoes being developed anywhere. They're not in a container. The container's not at a port where there's a spike. And I don't owe anybody any money, and nobody owes me any money. So.
what a great position to be in. Well, Bob, this has been a fantastic conversation. I think that, you know, you are of a certain age, as are Simon and I, and in addition to all of the business acumen that you've shared with us, I think that a 30-year-old would think that Bob Reif is a cool guy because of who you are, and a 30-year-old entrepreneur would think you're even cooler still. So thank you for sharing your coolness and your insight with us today. We really appreciate it.
Well, you're welcome, but let's make sure that we know that, you know, that Merrill was founded by some other people, and we just helped them succeed. And I hope that they get all the acclaim, you know, that they're due, because they're exemplary of what it takes to create something, and to also have a life experience that isn't quite what we planned for. But in the end, we're all happy, and it's all worked out. Thank you for the opportunity. I'm sorry I talked so much.
Yeah, no, thank you, Bob, and the energy that you've given this show, and you talk about the relevancy earlier and what you want to give back. You've given so much there. I mean, I was thinking as you were talking, I'd love to do a few rounds of golf with you just to learn more from you. So maybe we do that again, Mike, because it's been
fascinating. No, you can always just play the 19th hole. That's where all the keys are revealed.
Even better. We do hope you enjoyed this podcast, and thanks for listening to What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Dorr. Please join us at whatiwishiknewshow.com. You can subscribe to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Please share What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Dorr with your friends. We welcome your feedback and recommendations of new podcast guests and ideas on topics. If you have business challenges, we're also available for advisory and consulting roles. We'd be delighted to listen and help. Just send us an email. Our address is hello@whatiwishiknewshow.com.